Well done, everybody who's made it to the last lecture of the course. Should be a fun one. I hope it's going to be a fun one. So we're talking about interpretations of quantum theory, and our last topic is what I'm calling Copenhagenish interpretations. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So the first thing to say is there really is no Copenhagen interpretation. So it's kind of hard to define exactly what that is. It's supposed to refer to the views of, you know, some of the founders of quantum theory, most notably Bohr and Heisenberg, but also Pauli and, you know, Dirac and a list of other people who were hanging around Copenhagen at the time that quantum theory was first developed. However, if you read their views, if you go to the old papers where they stated what their views are, you'll find they're slightly different and contradictory. So in particular, Bohr is notoriously difficult to read, but Bohr and Heisenberg have some very notable disagreements on, for example, what exists and what's real and things like that. So normally when people say Copenhagen, at least certainly in the philosophy literature, they're concerned with analyzing Bohr's views. Bohr is very difficult to read, and there's a sort of mini industry in the history of physics where people produce papers saying, well, what Bohr really meant to say was this, and those are different accounts. So some of the issues that we've been discussing, the sort of more modern issues like Bell's theorem, contextuality, psi ontology, they weren't even formulated in Bohr's lifetime. So of course you won't find a clear statement on what he thought about them in the literature. In particular, Bohr, the most famous paper associated with the word Copenhagen interpretation is a paper that, a talk that Niels Bohr gave at a conference in Lake Como in Italy. That's often considered like one of the definitive statements of the Copenhagen interpretation. And if you read that paper, it's all about, largely about the uncertainty principle. He talks about positions and momentums and things. The word wave function or quantum state and what it means doesn't come up once in that entire paper. So what did he think of it? Difficult to say. So a historical note here. So Don Howard was the first, he's a philosopher of physics, was the first to make this argument. He argues that the idea of that there is something called a unified Copenhagen interpretation was invented by Heisenberg in the mid-1950s. You have to understand a bit of the history here. During the Second World War, Heisenberg was supposedly leading the German effort to build a nuclear weapon. And after the Second World War, he was very keen on trying to sort of restore his scientific reputation. So by sort of associating himself with these pre-war activities and talking about, you know, his association with Niels Bohr and the development of this interpretation, that was sort of one way that he was trying to go around and restore his reputation. Before the 1950s, there wasn't any, you didn't find people writing Copenhagen interpretation anywhere. People did speak of ideas that were in the Copenhagen spirit, but the idea that there was sort of a complete and conclusive interpretation wasn't mentioned. There was just, you know, the circle of ideas that people sort of partially disagreed about. So it's very difficult to argue against the Copenhagen interpretation if it doesn't really, well, actually, no, let me put it the other way. It's very easy to argue against the Copenhagen interpretation. All you have to do is go to the historical sources, find that people contradicted each other and say this makes no sense, right? But it's very hard to actually pin down what Copenhagen interpretation is. So in the intervening years, many people have tried to develop more fully worked out interpretations that are in some sense in the Copenhagen spirit. They're based on the same kind of circle of ideas. I'm going to call these Copenhagenish interpretations because a lot of the people who advocate these interpretations would hate it if you said they believe in the Copenhagen interpretation. I tried the word neo-Copenhagen interpretations for a while and they disliked that too. So now I'm just calling them Copenhagen-ish. It's kind of vague. So here are some examples of Copenhagen-like interpretations. I'm not going to go into too much detail. Maybe at the end, I'll talk about some of them in more detail. There's a key division, which I'll talk about in a minute, between objective Copenhagen interpretations and perspectival ones, okay? And there's some very recent results which bear on this distinction, which sort of seem to indicate that we really need to have a perspectival interpretation. So what does it mean roughly? I'll say it in a bit more detail, but an objective Copenhagen interpretation says that there's an objective fact of the matter about what an observer observes, right? So when a detector clicks, it really clicks. You may not know what the outcome of the measurement was, but there's a fact of the matter about there's been a click and it has some particular value. And perspectival interpretations say what's true depends on where you're sitting in some sense, right? So it might be that there's a fact of the matter that the detector has clicked for you, but no fact of the matter that it's clicked for me, okay? So I'm not really interested in analyzing history. What I'm going to try and do is formulate what I think are the principles that are common to all of these Copenhagenish interpretations. I'm not claiming these represent the views of Bohr, although such an argument could probably be made, but I will leave that argument to a historian of physics rather than me. So I'm interested in what's the coherent set of ideas that people might believe in now. So there's a recent result, actually it's just been published, so I should update that reference, by Frauscheiger and Renner. They've proved a theorem that makes life very difficult for the objective Copenhagenish interpretations. So I'm going to present a version of this theorem, which is really a lot indebted to the work of Louis Massanes and Matt Pusey. And it's really remarkable that we can prove any kind of no-go theorem about Copenhagenish interpretations at all. Because normally, Copenhagenish interpretations are immune to all no-go theorems. All the no-go theorems we've presented so far start by saying, you know, assume physical systems have some ontic state, lambda, and that's the first premise that Copenhagenish people deny. So normally you get no traction at all. So it's extremely unusual to be able to place constraints on these interpretations at all, which is the main reason why I think this theorem is interesting. So we're going to head towards that, but I'm going to work up towards it. Okay, so what are the principles behind Copenhagenish interpretations? So before saying that, this is what I think is the intuition behind it. So suppose you're deeply skeptical that the quantum formalism is a direct representation of reality. Okay, we've seen previously the arguments in favor of psi epistemicism, which may lead you to believe, you know, quantum states aren't states of reality and things like that. Nevertheless, you want the ordinary classical reality that we see around us to be straightforwardly true, right? So unlike in Everett, what the ontology of the theory is very abstract, and there's quite a lot of work that you have to do that we saw yesterday in order to account for the observance of our classical reality from an ontology that's just the wave function. Okay, so you might want our ordinary classical reality to be somehow straightforwardly true, and then nonetheless you want to view quantum theory as still a complete and fundamental theory of physics. We have, you know, that's also a reasonable thing to do because at the moment we have no evidence that quantum theory ever goes wrong. Okay, so that's kind of the intuition behind it. Here are the four formal principles which I'll go through in more detail. Okay, so the first one, observers observe. Okay, so here's the argument. So I know from my experience that I am the type of entity that experiences definite outcomes when I make a quantum measurement. Okay, I'm a theorist, so I don't make a lot of quantum measurements, but at least when I was an undergraduate, I was in the lab doing the double slit experiment, trying to prove that that photons behave as both particles and waves, right? So at that stage in my life, I did quantum measurements, and I did indeed see definite outcomes. I know that as a fact. Now, there's sort of a no-solipsism assumption here. No-solipsism means solipsism is sort of the view that the only thing I really know that exists is myself and my own perceptions, and I'm skeptical that you guys exist, right? So we're anti-solipsism here. So I posit that there are similar entities in the universe, for example, graduate students, and I don't doubt that they have the same experience. So if I send one of my graduate students in the lab into the lab to do a Stern-Gerlach experiment, I'm going to assume that they actually see definite outcomes as well, okay? So I just want to clarify here, this doesn't mean that consciousness, human observers, or anything like that are necessary in order for a definite outcome to occur. We could, for example, accept a decoherence account. When there's sufficient decoherence, then we can say a definite outcome occurs. The only thing I'm arguing here is that a human observation is sufficient for a definite outcome to occur, and I'm basing that on my personal experience. I know for a fact that I do see definite outcomes, okay? So we can divide this assumption into two versions. This is where the objective versus perspectival version comes in. The objective version says that if I send you into the lab to make a measurement, you observe the result, then the fact that there has been a definite result is an objective fact about the world. The detector really has clicked. I may not know that the detector has clicked, I may not know what the outcome is because I haven't interacted with you, but nonetheless, it's part of the furniture of the universe, if you like, that there has been a detector click. That's the objective version. The perspectival version says that when you make a measurement and observe the result, then that's a fact of the matter for you, but there's no fact of the matter for me until such a time as I repeat the measurement myself or I interact with you. If you tell me, oh, I got this measurement outcome, then it becomes a fact for me, but before that time, there's just no fact of the matter about it. Okay, so those are two versions. They both say that measurement outcomes really exist, but it's a question of for whom do they exist? Do they exist for everybody or just for the person who's seen it? Any questions about that assumption? Okay, so that's really the starting point, and you know, Copenhagenish interpretations are in some sense known for being hard-headed empiricist interpretations. They take the empirical facts, the experimental records as the basis on which we build something, and that's kind of what this assumption is about. Universality. Okay, now it says, this is basically says, quantum theory is a fundamental physical theory. I've been careful to say quantum theory and not quantum mechanics in here because quantum field theories and everything like that, they're also quantum theories. Then it says that anything in the universe, if not everything at once, can in principle be described by quantum theory. So there's no fundamental divide between classical and or non-quantum systems and quantum systems in the universe. Now you might think, oh, this is sort of seems like kind of anti-Copenhagen type of principle, because in Copenhagen, isn't there always a split between the classical world and the quantum world? And yes, there is, but the point is that in Copenhagen, that split was also always supposed to be arbitrarily movable, right? So you may not be able to describe the entire universe at once, and I'll explain why in a minute, but in principle, I can take any system in the universe and say I'm going to give a quantum description to that. So in principle, that means I can arrange a situation in which I would describe the state of you, the state of a student, as a superposition of macroscopically distinct states, if I wanted to. I could arrange that situation. It may be a very difficult thing to do in practice, but in principle, I can give a quantum description of you. Right? So this is the respect in which Copenhagenism isn't operationalism. It doesn't involve an undefined primitive of measurement, right? Everything obeys quantum mechanics in principle, and in this regard, it's very similar to the Everett interpretation in that regard. Okay. So, a problem. So you might have thought, okay, well, we've got the measurement problem. So doesn't that immediately rule out the combination of these two assumptions, right? Because universality implies that I can describe a measurement via unitary coherent interaction, but observers observe, the fact that there are definite outcomes implies that I should have a collapse, right? So aren't those two just in contradiction? But that's only a contradiction on like the orthodox interpretation, because if you believe that the quantum states are objective ontic states of reality, or if you assume something like the eigenvalue-eigenstate link, then these two descriptions are contradictory, because they describe different states of affair in reality, states of affairs in reality. But if you're something like a psi epistemicist, these things aren't real. They don't represent a state of reality. So there's no obvious contradiction yet, right? So in order to have these two things together, we really do need a third assumption, which I'm calling anti-psi ontology, okay? I would personally be happy to call this psi epistemicism, because that's kind of what I mean by it. But when I talk to advocates of these interpretations, they're very sort of, they're very wedded to particular ways of talking about things. So epistemic means knowledge, and some people say, oh no, quantum states don't represent knowledge, they represent something else. But the important thing is that they're not ontic. They are not intrinsic properties of an individual quantum system. Quantum systems don't go round with quantum states attached to them, right? Instead, they represent something else. Some of the things that people say they represent are our knowledge, our information, our beliefs, what we can say. There's a famous quote by Niels Bohr where he says, physics is about what we can say about physical systems or something like that. So that's where that comes from. And advice. All of these come from specific papers of specific Copenhagenish interpretations, right? So it depends which Copenhagenish view we're considering, which of these is right, but the important thing is that they are not intrinsic properties of an individual quantum system. Okay, so as a conclusion of that, we say, therefore, if we have two different descriptions of a measurement that need not be an actual contradiction, they could just represent the descriptions of two different observers who happen to have access to different information. So maybe this is, so if I put you inside a box to do a measurement and you see the outcome, maybe this is your description and this would be my description of what's going on. No necessary contradiction here because those quantum states don't represent reality. Okay, so that's three assumptions. And then there's a fourth assumption, which is completeness. And this is where Copenhagenish interpretations would strongly differ from a realist psi epistemic interpretation, right? So a Spekin's toy theory type of thing wouldn't satisfy this assumption here. So the assumption is that there's no deeper description to be had, right? So despite the fact that the quantum formalism doesn't represent reality, nonetheless, I'm not going to assign ontic states to systems we're describing quantum mechanically. Quantum mechanical description is all there is. That's the bottom. That's where things end. Now, why could this happen? I think there are two reasons. Like, if this is true, there are two reasons. One is you could think that, well, you know, quantum systems do have properties. They do have some properties, ontic properties, but those are fundamentally ineffable. I like that word, ineffable, but what it means, ineffable means it's literally impossible to talk about them, right? Where the word comes from is that theologians, it's a theological word, so God is supposed to be ineffable, right? That's where this word comes from. So the idea here is that, the moon is there when nobody's looking at it, but somehow it's fundamentally impossible to describe its properties in any way whatsoever. You can't describe them in language, pictures, mathematics, computer code, or anything else you could imagine. They're just indescribable. It has properties, but you can't describe them. So the other possibility is that quantum systems actually have no properties. So the moon is not there when nobody's looking. So that's what the objection that Einstein had to the Copenhagen interpretation. I actually think original Copenhagen is somehow more along these lines, but again, however carefully you read Bohr, you may come up with different conclusions. So if you're going to have an objective Copenhagenish interpretations, if measurement outcomes are really going to have definite values, then it has to be one, because it just has to be that if you go and do a measurement and I describe you as a superposition, because I'm describing you quantum mechanically, I can't assign you definite properties, but nonetheless, if I think that the measurement has really occurred has to be that those properties exist, I'm just unable to describe them, right? So that's necessary if you want an objective Copenhagenish interpretation. Option two can be made perspectival in the sense that, in the following sense, we could say, for me, the moon has no properties when I'm not looking at it. It may have properties for you, right? Because maybe you're looking at the moon, right? Or you've made a measurement on the moon and I haven't, right? So it might be that it has properties for you because you're not describing it quantum mechanically, but it doesn't have properties for me because I am describing it quantum mechanically. So in either case, the quantum states just represent one of these things, information, knowledge, etc., about the outcomes of future measurements you might make. They don't represent properties of the system, because the key thing is that when we're describing something quantum mechanically, we don't ascribe it properties. Okay, so these four principles are indeed in a certain amount of tension. So for example, if universality is true, I can choose to describe you when you make a measurement as in a coherent superposition. But if completeness is true, it means that there's nothing I can add to that description, right? I can't ascribe you any properties when I'm describing you in this way. But if I want to account for my own observations, right? If I'm saying I make an observation, then that is ascribing a property to me. I have made an observation with a definite value. So therefore, that implies that I necessarily cannot include myself in my quantum descriptions, right? By observers observe, I assume I observe definite outcomes. A quantum mechanical description of me renders it impossible for me to say that that definite outcome exists. So therefore, I must always exclude myself from my quantum descriptions. So therefore, anybody using quantum theory necessarily has to split the world into two parts, right? So we're deriving the necessity of this split from our four assumptions. We're not assuming that there's some real split in the world. We're deriving that it needs to be there. So I have to describe the world as some part I'm going to describe quantum mechanically, and then there's going to be a part that I'm going to exclude from that description in order that I can ascribe it properties. It needs to be outside the quantum description to ascribe it properties. And the splits between these two parts is usually called the Heisenberg cut. Okay? So, any questions at this point? Everybody with me? Okay, so, however, if universality is true, there can't be a fundamental place where I have to put the Heisenberg cut. It's movable. This idea that you can move the Heisenberg cut around was called, perhaps disparagingly, the shifty split by John Bell. You have to be very careful about how you say shifty split, because it's very easy to say something a lot ruder than that. Okay, so if you look at the original Copenhagen idea, the idea is that where should you put this split? You need to decide that pragmatically. There will always be a lowest level at which you can place the split. If I'm happening to do a coherent interference experiment between two states in a wave function, then I will need to use a quantum description to get the predictions right. I won't get the predictions right if I put that on the classical side. So the lowest level, there'll be a lowest level that's capable of getting the predictions of the experiment right. There's also going to be a highest level. You have to always put the split in front of yourself because you need to ascribe properties to yourself. So, but in between the two, there'll be a range of levels at which you can make the same predictions, right? You may choose to include your measurement device in the quantum description or exclude it from the description, right? So the fact that when you make different levels of description, the quantum states that you assign are going to be different. Like when an observation has happened is going to be different. That's not necessarily a contradiction because we're anti-Scientologists here. All you care about is that the different levels agree on the predictions for experiments that are actually performed. Okay, then we have agreement on what's actually happening. All right. So this leads to the idea of level agreement and level disagreement. So each observer that exists has a different range of levels between their highest and lowest, right? So for example, if I put you inside a box and you're making a measurement, you have to put your highest level in front of you. But if I'm going to do a coherent interference experiment on you, my lowest level has to be above the box, right? So you might have thought that for any two observers, it's always possible to find a range of levels they can agree on, right? So this is the idea here, right? So if Alice and Bob, if Alice's lowest level is below Bob's highest level, then in this region, there will be a description of the experiment that they can both agree on. And here is the idea of level conflict, which is if Bob's highest possible level is higher than Alice's lowest level, then there's no description they can agree on, right? They don't agree on where you can put the cut. So the Vigna's friend experiment, as I'm about to explain to you, shows that level conflicts can happen. So what's Vigna's friend? Well, I've sort of described it already. But the Vigna's friend experiment is like Schrodinger's cat experiment, except that instead of putting a cat in the box, Vigna puts his friend inside a box to make a measurement. Okay? The main difference here, which is relevant for Copenhagenish interpretations, is that the entity inside the box is unambiguously an observer. Right? If I put a human inside the box, that's something I'm treating as an observer. With a cat, it's perhaps, cat is probably an observer, but we want to remove that ambiguity. Now we're going to replace enough stuff inside the box in order for an observation to occur, right? So if you think you need environmental decoherence, for example, in order for there to be definite measurement outcomes, then put a large enough environment inside the box. Put the entire Earth inside the box if you want, right? Just something that we can describe as an isolated system, but is large enough for you to believe that a definite observation has occurred. Okay, so after the friend has made the measurement, but before Vigna opens the box, Vigna certainly can place the cut above his friend. A universality allows that, and give this description of what's going inside the box. But the friend's highest level is always below herself, so she's necessarily going to have collapsed the wave function and updated it. So the friend might say, oh, we want to come into agreement. So the friend might say, well, come on, Vigna, why don't you put your cut a bit lower so we can reach level agreement? But Vigna might say, sorry, I'm planning on doing an interference experiment on you, so this is my lowest possible level. Then there's a level conflict that can't be resolved. Okay, is that a big problem? Well, you might think, no, it's okay, so long as we reach level agreement in the long run. Okay, so you might think, well, let's replace the idea that we always must have level agreement with the idea that in the long run you get level agreement. So level conflicts do happen, admittedly in rather impractical experiments. However, perhaps after the whole experiment is over, level agreement is always going to be possible. The reason why you might think this is that one way of concluding the experiment is for Vigna to open the box or just ask the friend what their measurement outcome is. Once he's interacted, they'll both be able to agree what the measurement outcome was, and they'll both be able to place the cut below the friend, and at that stage they'll agree. Okay, they'll have a level agreement. Okay, so if that always happened, then life would be nice, but that doesn't always happen. Because if Vigna actually does a coherent experiment on his friend, then the disagreement persists. So I call this, this is my terminology, I like to call this the Vigna's enemy experiment. So instead of just finding out what outcome the friend got, he does a coherent interference experiment. This experiment involves Vigna erasing his friend's memory, so it's a pretty nasty thing to do. You wouldn't do that to your friend, so I call it Vigna's enemy experiment. So friends don't recohere friends, is the idea. Okay, so let's give a rough description of what this looks like. So I'm going to cheat a bit and imagine that the friends, just so I can describe the friend as a two-dimensional system, very, very rough model, I'm going to say that the state in which the friend is ready to make the measurement is the same as the one in which she's observed spin up. Right, now we can treat her as a qubit. And here's a unitary interaction that does the measurement. Okay, it correlates the state of the frames. Basically, if the spin is down, then it flips. And in order to make it unitary, I have to say what happens to the other states of the frame. So this is one unitary interaction that does it. And if you're familiar with quantum information, you can see that's basically a C0 gate, but it doesn't matter. This unitary happens to be its own inverse, so Wigner can undo the measurement and recohere his friend just by applying it a second time. So Wigner takes this state here, applies that unitary operation to it. What does he get? He gets this. It just undoes the measurement. But the friend, if the wave function has collapsed, on the other hand, the friend is either in this state or that state. If you consider this state, then undoing the measurement does this and leaves her state unchanged, right? So now they disagree. After the undoing, both the friend and Wigner agree that their state is uncorrelated with the system, so they don't have a level conflict, because level conflicts are really about which systems am I going to describe as being entangled, right? So if there's no correlation, they can reach level agreement. But they disagree on the state of the spin. However, we've done something illegitimate here, which somebody should immediately raise their hand and say, Matt, you've done something you're not allowed to do here. What is it? Yeah.
Is it that her memory should be part of her state? And so if you've reverted her to the original state, she shouldn't also have memory of something else having happened?
It's not quite that. It's basically this that's problematic, because I told you that you mustn't apply quantum mechanics to yourself, right? So the friend isn't allowed to apply quantum mechanics to herself. Because for the friend to compute what happens in this recohering experiment, you need to apply quantum mechanics to herself. That conflicts with the idea that her highest level is before herself. So what could we do here? One thing we could do is just say, well, the friend's application of quantum theory there is illegitimate. So only Wigner's description is reliable there. I mean, it's kind of like this undoing experiment is kind of in some ways equivalent to hitting the friend on the head with a hammer so that they get amnesia about the measurement result. And you wouldn't expect the friend to be able to describe what's going on there physically. It's a little bit problematic because it says, you know, there are some possible experiments which observers can't make a physical description. So we could say that. Or we could also say, well, the friend's application of quantum theory is actually okay in this case, we'll allow it. But we don't need to insist that observers assign the same state to the system even when they reach level agreement. We are anti-Scientologists after all. They could assign different states, and that doesn't necessarily mean. Anyway, none of this, even though it's sometimes argued that way, none of this really says that the difference of quantum state assignments doesn't prove that objective observations don't exist, right? None of this proves that, because this is all about the differences between two different observers' descriptions and nothing about what's really happening, what's the real observations. So in order to prove that, we're going to need, or in order to, I wouldn't say prove it, in order to say anything about that, we need to look at the Frauscheiger-Renner argument. Okay. So what's the Frauscheiger-Renner argument? It's basically a mashup of Bell's theorem and Wigner's friend. Okay, so we're going to do Wigner's enemy. We're going to do a Wigner's enemy version of Bell's theorem. So suppose we have two systems that are prepared in a maximally entangled state. So Alice has one of these qubits and Bob has the other one. Alice has one of two observables she's going to measure on system A, and Bob has one of two observables he's going to measure on system B. These are two outcome observables. They're exactly the same observables as in the CHSH argument. Now, what we're going to do is consider the experiment entirely from the point of view of a third observer, so Wigner. So Wigner is going to put Alice and Bob and these qubits inside a box, and he's going to describe the whole thing by coherent unitary interactions. Now, what this means is that any time Alison Bob measures an observable, Wigner can potentially undo that measurement by reversing the coherent unitary interaction that he describes it with. So instead of the usual Bell setup, what we'll do is we'll have Alice and Bob measure both of their observables, one after the other. So Alice is going to measure both AH and A tails. But the difference is that Wigner is going to reverse the first measurement in between the two. So Alice makes her first measurement. Wigner's describing that as a coherent unitary interaction. He can reverse it. And then subsequently, Alice makes her second measurement, similarly for Bob. So that's the setup. Okay, so let's see what this is, what this looks like from Wigner's perspective. So from Wigner's perspective, all this is happening inside a Bob box. Here's Alice's measurement interaction. Wigner reverses it. Here's her second measurement interaction. Actually, I think this should have been AH and AT with my notation on the previous slide, but it doesn't matter. Now I'm calling them A0 and A1. Sorry about that. So let's imagine that we assume the objective version of observers observe. It means that when a human observer does a measurement, there's a fact of the matter about what outcome they got. And that's a feature of the universe. It's not observer dependent in the objective version. What does that mean? It means there's a fact of the matter about what outcome is obtained on every run of this experiment. Okay, so on one run of the experiment, over here, Alice obtains the outcome A0. Over here, she obtains the outcome A1, B0 and B1, and those are facts, right? Wigner can't possibly know those facts because he's describing the whole thing quantum mechanically. They're ineffable to him, but nonetheless, we're asserting that they exist in the objective version of observers observe. So if you were to repeat this experiment multiple times, then the relative frequencies of those outcomes exist, and hence a joint probability distribution exists, right? Nobody can know this joint probability distribution, but the assumption implies that it exists. Okay, that's the important thing. Wigner can't know what this is, but it exists on the objective version of observers observe. So we can write down a joint probability distribution just because there are relative frequencies. Okay, now we invoke Fine's theorem, which is it's actually very simple, but this is usually called Fine's theorem. So the theorem says the existence of a locally causal model for a Bell experiment is equivalent to the existence of a joint probability distribution over all the observables, the marginals of which give the correct operational predictions. But we only need the converse part here. We have a joint probability distribution. We need to know that there's a locally causal model. And it's very simple. We just let lambda, our ontic state, be a list of the outcomes for this particular run of the experiment. So it just lambda literally just lists which outcomes should occur. So we let the probability of lambda just be the joint probability distribution that we've said asserted exists. And the conditional probabilities just read off the outcome, right? So if x is 0, it reads out A0. If x is 1, it reads out A1. Right, similarly for Bob. So it's very straightforward to see that if I look at the probability of A, B given x and y, it obeys local causality. That's local causality. And the marginals here will be just the marginals of this probability distribution. So the marginals of this probability distribution, so first of all, this probability distribution implies there exists a locally causal model, and the marginals should agree with the probabilities that quantum mechanics says should exist. Okay. So now we've determined that there's a local model for this experiment. So that would imply that if all these marginals agree with quantum mechanics, then, the fact that there's a local model implies that the outcomes have to satisfy Bell inequalities. But we know that the quantum predictions do not satisfy the Bell inequalities. The conclusion of that is that at least one of these marginal distributions must have failed to agree with the predictions of quantum mechanics for that state and those measurements. Otherwise, we have a contradiction. Now, the question that we have to asks now is which of these marginals have to obey the quantum predictions on pain of actually being able to violate quantum mechanics. Now, that depends on how Wigner performs this experiment. So let me put it this way. If a pair of Alice and Bob's outcomes can persist for a very long time, such that they could get together and talk to each other, write Nature paper about it and get it published, then that corresponding marginal must obey the quantum predictions, otherwise you'll be able to write a paper for Nature saying quantum mechanics is violated. So on pain of violating quantum mechanics, so remember that Wigner is sort of an all-powerful observer here. So if Alice and Bob get together and talk to each other, we imagine that inside this box is the entire Earth, and including the Nature publishing offices and all this kind of stuff. And Wigner's describing that whole thing as a coherent unitary evolution. So when he does the undoing of the measurements, he can also undo the whole publication of the paper, etc. But at least there will be a time period inside the box where they would say quantum mechanics is violated. So that we want to rule out. However, if they don't persist long enough for Alice and Bob to get together and discuss them, then their marginal, strictly speaking, doesn't have to obey quantum theory. So let's look at what this means. Let's suppose that Wigner implements, so this is now what things look like in space-time. Let's suppose Wigner implements the experiment in this way. So our big T here is going to be a very long time, 10 years, say, and a little t is going to be a very short time, half a nanosecond, right, I've set here, okay? So the idea is that Alice first does her measurement here, it persists for 10 years, then the undoing happens, then very quickly the new measurement happens. And here, we allow Bob's first outcome to persist for 20 years before it's quickly undone. Now the point here is that there is a long period of time where both of these measurement outcomes exist. There's a long period of time where this one and this one exists, and there's a long period of time where this one and this one exists. This one and this one exists. Okay, so we conclude from that these three marginal probability distributions have to be quantum, otherwise we'd violate quantum mechanics. But this one, A0 and B1, there's never a period of time in which Alice and Bob can get together and discuss them. So certainly if you're a strict operationalist, you'd say, well, everything's okay here. These three marginals obey quantum mechanics. This one doesn't. Nobody can ever verify it, so I don't care. We could also implement the experiment in this way, just exchanging the roles of Alice and Bob. So now we have the 20 years here and just the 10 years here. And here it would be a different three marginals. It'll be these three marginals that have to obey quantum mechanics, but A1, B0, never exist at the same time. Okay, so there's a loophole. You can't get to a flat out contradiction because there's always at least one marginal that doesn't have to be quantum. However you implement this experiment, you'll always find one margin, you know, that you won't be able to say that on pain of violating quantum mechanics, all four marginals have to agree in the same experiment. However, it's still very puzzling because there really isn't anything in the formalism of quantum theory that would explain why you should get different non-quantum marginals in these two experiments. You'd have to imagine that there's some kind of mechanism that, you know, communicates to Alice's system whether or not Bob's second measurement has happened yet, in order for you know, the measurement device to know whether it has to produce a probability obeying quantum mechanics or not. Now, if you were dealing with a hidden variable theory, you might be prepared to posit that there is just such a mechanism. There's a non-locality. That's actually how this experiment works in Bohmian mechanics. But in Copenhagenish quantum theory, we're just supposed to have bare quantum mechanics interpreted in a sort of anti-realistic way. That's the only resource we've got. Copenhagenists really only have the quantum formalism to rely on, and both of these experiments are described the same way in the quantum formalism. You might think they ought to make the same predictions. If you believe that, then you'd say, well, the same marginals have to be the same in both, have to be quantum in both experiments, and that would imply all of them do, and then you'd get a contradiction. Okay. There's another way of sort of strengthening that intuition is to say, well, there's another way we could perform the experiment would be at space-like separation. So suppose all of Alice's measurement and undoing and second measurement occur at space-like separation to Bob's. So it's true that for every pair, there's a frame of reference in which they coexist. Now, since everything's happening at space-like separation really quickly, Alice and Bob can't get together and discuss those measurement outcomes now. So strictly speaking, if you're a pure operationalist, you'd say, well, the only time Alice and Bob can get together and discuss it is after the second measurement. For all others, there isn't enough time for them to compare the results before it gets erased. But there seems to be no really, but you know, these joint probabilities are something, and you seem to have no really good reason for arbitrarily choosing which one of the marginals should be non-quantum in this case. Maybe all of them, but at least one of them has to be which one. But this experiment, you see, is just the same as these two experiments. It's just if I reduce big T from 10 years to 0.5 nanoseconds, right, then both of these experiments become this one. So this experiment is just both of the previous experiments just done a bit faster. Should performing an experiment a bit faster affect what needs to be quantum? For a Copenhagenist, right? For an operationalist, they just care about the operational predictions, fine. A Copenhagenist isn't an operationalist. They believe in the universality of quantum theory in some sense. So it seems that you have a big puzzle about deciding where and why things should be non-quantum. Arguably, the simpler explanation is to say, well, everything should be quantum. If everything's quantum, we have a contradiction. So, as I say, this is a loophole. It's strictly speaking a loophole, but the Copenhagenists I've talked to generally don't like taking this loophole because there's a lot of arbitrariness in it, in deciding. You have to have a rule for deciding which marginals should be non-quantum. That's not really something they want to do. If you believe in bare quantum theory, you shouldn't have to do that. Okay, so the obvious thing to do is to give up the objective version of observers observe. This leads you to perspectival Copenhagen interpretations. So the idea is that if Alice's outcomes only exist for Alice and Bob's outcomes only exist for Bob, and neither of them exist for Wigner, because he's describing them both quantum mechanically, then there is no global Wigner's perspective on which outcomes can be said to exist, right? There's no outside-the-box perspective on where you say that outcomes exist. And hence, there's no joint probability distribution anymore. There's no joint probability distribution, we're not able to use Fine's theorem, and we don't get the local causality. Okay, so there's at least a couple of interpretations like this in the literature, which I don't have a huge amount of time to go into, but I'll just sort of give you an outline. So cubism is probably the most well-known one. It's advocated by, for example, Chris Fuchs. It's a combination of two things. So pure subjective Bayesianism. So all probabilities are to be interpreted in the subjective Bayesian way, like in the sort of Dutch book argument type of way that we were talking about yesterday. So quantum states, because quantum states are uniquely determined by the probabilities they predict, it implies that quantum states represent the degrees of belief of a decision-making agent. Different agents will have different states because there's no objective probability. There will never be a requirement for two agents to assign the same state, even if they don't have level conflict, right? So this is complete subjective Bayesianism. But it's not just that, because you can have that for a classical interpretation of probability too. They also have this perspectival view, which is that an agent's quantum state describes beliefs about their own personal reality, right? If some other agent's observation is not reflected in that state, right, it's not collapsed onto them observing something definite, then it just simply doesn't exist for them. It's not part of their reality. It's quite a radical position, very radical interpretation, but it takes into account this perspectival view. Another interpretation that's like this is sometimes called relational quantum mechanics. It's by Carlo Rovelli. I believe he used the word relational incorrectly. Here, I think he should just call it perspectival quantum mechanics, because that's what it is. So his view is that physical systems don't have properties per se. They only have properties from the perspective of other systems. So I can talk about the properties of system A as described by system B, but I can't talk about the properties of system A on its own. The perspectival properties, however, are objective. Okay, perspectival properties. So the measurement outcome from the perspective of the physical system, so a measurement has an outcome from the perspective of the physical system, which is called the friend, but not from the perspective of the physical system called Wigner. Now, the properties are determined just by the eigenvalue-eigenstate link, but they're only applied perspectivally, right? So the friend, if he's describing the state of the system as collapsed, he can ascribe it a definite property of spin up or spin down by the eigenvalue-eigenstate link. But that doesn't have to agree with Wigner's description because they're describing it from the perspective of two different physical systems. So Rovelli thinks there's nothing special about measurements. So he would say you can equally talk about the properties of an electron from the perspective of another electron. I'm a little bit worried about that because although I think the formal mathematics of this is still to be worked out, I think this will run into a basis problem because if you have two qubits and it's supposed from Wigner's perspective, we should really write states like this. So psi of AB from Wigner's point of view is this. Okay, and presumably the state of B from A's point of view is either supposed to be 0B or AB or 1B. So this is psi of B from A's point of view. Because this is like a stereotypical measurement type of situation. But then I could also have written this as 1 over root 2 in a different basis, plus minus minus AB in a different basis. So how can I say that it should be the A state should be this and not the other one? So the question of whether there's really a good mathematics, I mean, some people are working on the mathematics of this and trying to make sense of it. So maybe it does make sense. But certainly what you could do is, if you think there's a basis problem, we could solve it by only assigning properties from the perspective of systems that are sufficiently decohered, right? Just solve the basis problem in the same way as Everett. So back away from saying that every system can describe every other system and say sufficiently large environmental systems that have been involved in decoherence can ascribe properties to the system, and then you'd be okay. But anyway, that's that's just my take on Rovelli. All right, so summary. So unless you're willing to permit contortions about which marginals are allowed to be non-quantum, Frauscheiger-Renner essentially rules out Copenhagenish interpretations, which is most of them, except these two that are still on the market. It's really remarkable to constrain Copenhagenish interpretations at all. As I said, most no-go theorems start off with an assumption that there exists a lambda. Here we didn't start off with that, we inferred it from the other assumptions. Perspectival move won't necessarily appeal to many Copenhagenists because one of the appeals of Copenhagen, one of the reasons why so many physicists still say that they agree with the Copenhagen interpretation is it's really supposed to be a hard-headed empiricist interpretation. It's supposed to say, look, all I care about is the detector clicks, the measurement outcomes, they're right? Things we see in the lab do straightforwardly happen. That's, I think, one of the appeals of Copenhagen, as opposed to, say, Everett. Everett, on the other hand, says, no, that's not right. There's a rather long path from the ontology to understanding what we see in the lab as an emergent phenomenon. So if you have that kind of level-headed empiricist reason for believing in Copenhagen, this result might drive you towards realism, if you don't like the perspectival one. But on the other hand, then we also have plenty of results that make realism problematic too. So my take on this is that we should probably, so Copenhagen is weirder than you thought it was, right? This is my take on it. And we should probably try to investigate in more detail exotic types of ontology that don't fit into the ontological models framework and maybe can get around all of these no-go results. Okay, so that's pretty much it, but I just want to say something in summary of the whole course. We have looked at, you know, the mathematical foundations, conceptual foundations, and interpretations. The operational stuff at the beginning has a lot to do with the way we actually go about doing calculations in quantum theory. It's not just, foundations isn't just about adding philosophical words on top of the existing math. there are many ways of providing an ontology for quantum theory that save the phenomena, right? De Broglie-Bohm works, spontaneous collapse works, perspectival Copenhagen works, Everett works to some degree, right? So we have to focus now not on trying to solve this problem, but try to focus on finding which is correct, or more probably that none of them are correct and something else is correct. And the way that we can determine correctness is to just see, well, the correct theory should really lead to some progress in physics, right? That's how we determine the pragmatic criterion, how we determine what's really right in physics. So if you are somebody who's going to decide to pursue quantum foundations, I hope you will contribute to this, but most people who take this course aren't going to do quantum foundations. So if you're doing your quantum field theory or quantum gravity or string theory or whatever you end up doing, I hope you'll occasionally take a pause and think about some of the issues that we've talked about. You know, what would a psi epistemicist think is going on in the thing that you're doing? What do the various interpretations say is happening? Does a particular experiment in, say, black hole physics suggest a new approach to the foundations of quantum theory? If you do that, you're going to end up doing your physics from a very different way from others in your field and maybe make progress, especially since most physicists don't spend a lot of time thinking about quantum foundations. Okay, so thank you. It's been a pleasure to teach this course, and I hope you got something out of it. And now, any questions, comments?
So what is the state of unitarity evolution in this in the Copenhagen interpretation?
The statement is that, so when I'm going to describe some experiment or something that I want to use quantum mechanics for, I first have to choose where I'm going to place a cut between the system that I'm describing quantum mechanically and the system I'm not describing quantum mechanically. And the system I'm describing quantum mechanically, I say that unitary evolution universally applies to it, right? So it always evolves unitarily. But the status of everything is everything in the quantum formalism only represents knowledge, information, or something like that. So even the unitary evolution is an evolution of something that's only representing knowledge or information, and there's nothing deeper. Anything else?
If there are no questions, let's thank Matt for a great series of lectures.
Thank you.